Welcome to History Counts. The purpose of this series is to bring to you the true facts of history. History provides the roadmap for the future, and the future belongs to the people. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. The 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon is a casus belli of what the United States calls its global war on terror. Since the attack, independent researchers have raised important questions in an effort to discover the true facts of the attack. In the following hour, we will explore some of these questions with one of the foremost independent 9/11 scholars, Professor David Ray Griffin. I'll be back with Professor Griffin after this short break. Our guest today is Professor David Ray Griffin, one of the foremost 9/11 scholars. His books on 9/11 include The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11, published in 2004, and Debunking 9/11 Debunking, published in 2007, which responds to the defenders of the official conspiracy theory. A widely published theologian, David Ray Griffin is Professor Emeritus of Philosophy of Religion and Theology at the Claremont School of Theology in California. Thanks very much for being with us today, Professor Griffin. You've raised many interesting points regarding 9/11. I'd like to start, if we could, with the attack on the Pentagon, which occurred at 9:38 in the morning on September 11th, killing 125 people. The official version of the story is that the Pentagon was struck by a Boeing 757, American Airlines Flight 77, and that it was piloted by a hijacker named Hani Hanjour, accompanied by several other hijackers. Now, in your book, you mentioned that Jamie McIntyre of CNN, who was an eyewitness reporter at the scene, he said, quote, "From my close-up inspection, there is no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon," end quote. Can you talk about the significance of the debris at the Pentagon crash site?
Many of us had originally misunderstood McIntyre's quote. He was responding to someone who had said it looks like the plane didn't hit the Pentagon. It landed somewhere near the Pentagon. And he was saying, no, nothing landed anywhere near the Pentagon. There's only what hit the Pentagon. So he was more orthodox than that quote has often made him sound. Yet at the same time, he gave very valuable testimony because he said in that same interview, there are no pieces of a plane bigger than what you can pick up in your hand. Well, you know, you cannot, those engines on those planes are virtually indestructible. And the landing gear, and you would have a huge tail section and so on. And so that was pretty strong testimony that this was not a giant airliner.
So there were no wing sections, no tail sections, no fuselage, no
Everybody agrees on that. We have also Karen Kwiatkowski, who was a lieutenant colonel who was working at the Pentagon at that time, and she said she saw no debris that would suggest that there'd been an airliner strike. April Gallup, who was inside the Pentagon and she, with her son, and they were both injured, and but she got her way out, and she said she came out the path where the plane allegedly went in, and she says, "I saw no plane." So this was pretty universal that nobody saw anything that suggested the remnants of a giant airliner.
Now, the FBI, I understand, removed the debris, and it wasn't documented.
They, there were certainly people in shirts and ties out there just sweeping the going along in big lines and picking up pieces. But they were, like Jamie McIntyre said, just pieces you could pick up in your hand. And yeah, they put them in a big container and took them away. And then graders came and literally covered up whatever remaining evidence there was by putting gravel, dirt and gravel, all over the lawn there.
Doesn't a Boeing 757 have parts which could be identified from serial numbers or?
That's right. There's been a lot of discussion about why we haven't seen the videos. The Department of Justice has admitted, and the Pentagon has admitted, there would have been about 80 cameras focused on the Pentagon, and so there would be a whole bunch of videos. They have shown us a few seconds from two of those cameras, and telling us that really that's all there is. Well, why don't they show us the rest of them and let us judge for ourselves? But in any case, there's been an enormous amount of discussion about what we would learn if we could see the videos.
What reason does the government give for not making available these videos?
They don't really give a reason. You know, it would have something to do, insofar as they give reasons, it has to do with national security.
So these would be cameras, security cameras from, say, I understand a gas station had one, hotels that might have caught the moment of impact.
That's right, and the Virginia transportation system, and yeah, and I don't know where they all were. There would have been a lot of cameras on the Pentagon itself, of course. But in any case, there are also the point you brought up, that one of the pilots or one of the former military men in the 9/11 Truth movement has stressed. This is George Nelson, that he used to be an accident investigator, and he says that every plane has all of these what they call time change parts. That is, there are parts that tend to wear out over a certain period of time or after so many miles. And so they're marked to be replaced every so often. And each of those has a very precise, you know, particular unique number to it. So that every part on these planes, at least all these time change parts, can be identified. So if the FBI had wanted to convince us that this was really Flight 77, all they had to do was pull out a bunch of those time change parts and show us the numbers and show us they matched up with Flight 77. And, of course, that hasn't been done. And, in fact, in the official discussions, there's been no discussion of the existence of time change parts whatsoever.
Were there any bodies at the site?
Well, there were certainly bodies. There were certainly the 125 people who were killed in the Pentagon,
How about on the airplane? Yeah.
Yeah, they tell us that when all the bodies showed up at the morgue, which was the Army's morgue, which is not what it should have been. It should have been, as I discuss in the book, the local one, but the military claimed it had priority. And so anyway, the bodies all showed up there at the same time, but they were transported to an intermediate stop. So there was a place where, if one wanted to imagine that maybe there wasn't a plane with passengers on it, but that the people had been killed somewhere else and then brought and mixed together with the other bodies, there was a place where that could have happened.
Did any eyewitnesses see bodies at the crash site right after the crash?
Well, they would have seen bodies, but the devastation was pretty severe, and so to identify passenger bodies as opposed to people who were in the Pentagon, and not everybody in the Pentagon was someone who would have been wearing a military uniform. So it wouldn't have been so easy to tell.
Who was a civilian employee of the Pentagon and who may have been on a plane?
That's right.
How about if we could look
but
at
But they also said, many people said, we saw no seats, we saw no luggage.
any of the things that you'd expect to see at the crash of a big Boeing 757.
That's right. That's right.
Were there the bodies of the hijackers, alleged hijackers, ever discovered or DNA connections made with them?
Well, there's been a lot of spin about this. You know, popular mechanics will tell you that there was positive identification of the five hijackers. But when you look at the autopsy report, and this was the military's own autopsy report, it did not say there was a positive identification. All they said was there were five bodies that could not be identified, and so they inferred that those were the bodies of the...
But they never actually connected them.
Well,
nobody,
and, you know, even there were some of the families of some of the alleged hijackers who offered to submit DNA, but there's been no public acknowledgement that the FBI ever responded to that. So to my knowledge and everybody else's that I know of, they never gathered any DNA, although obviously they knew who, you know, they knew where the whereabouts of the families. They could have gotten DNA from the families of all 19 of the alleged hijackers, and they never did it.
I see. Now, looking at the physical damage, what can be said from the exterior and interior damage to the Pentagon with respect to what it was hit by?
Well, it's ambiguous. At first, from the photos, we thought that there was a hole that was no more than 18 feet in diameter. Turns out that under the water that was being sprayed in there when those photos were being taken, there was a bigger hole, more like 90 feet across. That's still pretty small for a Boeing 757, which has a wingspan of 125 feet, and coming in at an angle would have had a even bigger swath.
The idea is that the government's idea is the plane came at practically ground level, correct?
That's right. It was it struck between the first and the second floors, but that means that that would be where that 18-foot hole was, which would be about the size of the nose. But that means that the bigger gash was almost there at ground level, which would mean that the engines, which stuck under the wings, should have been digging into the Pentagon lawn. And yet, when you look at the photos of the Pentagon lawn, there are no gashes in it. It's pristine. There was absolutely no marks from the plane,
and no engines themselves either.
There was never reported, and certainly no photos showed any engines. Now, you've got all sorts of stories about, well, they went inside, and then they were burned up, they vaporized. We really got nonsensical, contradictory stories that on the one hand, these steel engines vaporized, and yet they were able to identify the bodies by their...
The government actually contends that the planes, parts of the plane vaporized?
Well, you got these rumors, and whether anybody from the government said that, but those were that became kind of the semi-official story that was going around. And this Purdue study that came out not too long ago said something like this. It said that the plane liquefied, turned into essentially liquid. It's just...
Well, that would require a very high temperature.
Oh, yes. And
I suspect higher than...
At the same time, they're saying they were able to identify the bodies. So, you know, a fire that...
I don't think a hydrocarbon fire could generate that kind of a heat.
No, of course not. But even if you imagine that some kind of fire could get up to... we would be up in the... somewhere over 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, I believe, then there would have been nothing remaining from the bodies that you could have identified.
Certainly, and I think a hydrocarbon fire, from what I understand, maxes out at around 1,200 degrees.
Well, under the most ideal conditions, it can get up between 1700 to 1800 degrees. But that's a controlled flame, not an open flame. So, yeah,
right.
An open flame, you know, the hottest forest fire in the world might get up 1400, 1500 degrees, I believe.
Now you mentioned, you also discuss in your book the damage to the interior in the C-ring of the Pentagon, which I take as something like a third wall, that there was a penetration to that extent in the building. Was that significant?
Well, it's one of the big contradictions. The Pentagon by definition has five rings, and so the C-ring would be the middle of the five buildings and its back wall. The idea was that this hole in this C-ring was at the right place where if Flight 77 had come in at the angle they said it did and then gone through these three buildings, that's where the hole would have been punched out by the nose of the plane. And, of course, the big problem there is the nose of a 757 is extremely fragile and would not have made it through the reinforced outside wall, let alone go clear through.
So it would have to get through the exterior steel and concrete and then through additional walls in the inside of the building.
Yeah, the other walls were not really solid walls, so that wasn't the problem. But there were a lot of pillars in there. It would have had to wind its way through, and that's where the Purdue study comes in, says, well, it turned into liquid, and that's how it was able to get through. But in any case, you had that hole back there, and these people swore. You know, Rumsfeld said, they could even see. People told him they could see the nose sticking through into the driveway. But that was such nonsense, even popular mechanics wouldn't buy it because they knew that couldn't be. So they just came up with their own theory. And they said, well, what really happened was it was the landing gear that came through the building and punched out that hole. And just all on their own. And they say that's the truth. But that doesn't come from any report. All they had was a report that said the landing gear showed up about 20 feet from there, but it was 20 feet before there, so the landing gear would have had to gone through there, punch out that hole all the way through, and then bounce back about 20 feet. And the physics I remember doesn't allow that.
You quote an engineer named Mike Myers who suggested that the hole in the C-ring was so cleanly cut that it suggested there had been a shaped charge of a high explosive.
Yeah, people who have really looked at this and have some sort of technological knowledge about these things, which I don't have, and so I don't try to get into theories about what really happened, but they suggest it looks like some sort of explosive device. Makes much more sense than either the nose of the plane or the landing gear.
Can you talk about the maneuver that the aircraft had to take in order to impact the Pentagon at that point?
Well, and this is a decisive thing, as I say, in debunking 9/11 debunking. People can debate back and forth about whether, you know, how much debris there was there and whether the hole is commensurate with the size of a 757, the kind of damage it would cause, and so on. But there's one thing everybody in the 9/11 truth movement agrees on, and that is that whatever hit the Pentagon, it was not Flight 77 under the control of Hani Hanjour, because this flight, according to all reports, took came in over the Pentagon and could have crashed right into the roof could have crashed right into the part of the Pentagon where Rumsfeld and all the top brass were. And one would think a priori that if you had al-Qaeda terrorists who hated the American military and wanted to get revenge, that's what they would have done. But instead, the plane takes an amazing 333-degree downward spiral in which it descends about 8,000 feet in under 4 minutes and then comes in at virtually ground level. and slams in there. And we have in the 9/11 movement, we have an organization called Pilots for 9/11 Truth. And some of the pilots are former airline pilots, and like Russ Wittenberg, who was a military pilot in Vietnam and then flew the big birds, as they call them, for 35 years. He says, I don't think, with all my years of experience, I could have done that in a 757. I know Hani Hanjour couldn't, because Hani Hanjour was known by everybody to be a horrible pilot. Just a couple months before 9/11, he was trying to take training in a little single engine plane, and the trainer wouldn't go up with him a second time. He said, "You're too dangerous." And yet, this guy was supposed to have jumped in the cockpit of this 757, which he had never been in before. He had certainly never flown any big airplane before. And flown it back to Washington, found the Pentagon, you know, without any help from any radar. And then, but, you know, popular mechanics says, oh, well, that's no problem. All he had to do is punch in the coordinates on the GPS, and that would take him right to the Pentagon. And then the flight was only flown manually the last 8 minutes, and that's where they drop it. Well, of course, it was the last 8 minutes in which the impossible was done.
Right.
We have another pilot, Ralph Olmholt, who says, you know, the idea that Hani Hanjour flew that trajectory is just too absurd to even discuss.
What are some of the other options, if it wasn't a Boeing 757, that it was something remotely guided, perhaps?
Yeah, even people who believe it was a 757 say that the only way it could have happened was if it were technologically controlled. There is a capacity. There's been this for some time of technological override. So,
So it wouldn't necessarily have to be a missile. It could be a passenger plane under remote control.
Yeah, there are various theories, all the way from a 757 or some other airliner, all the way down to a missile. And in between, you have various other theories. I myself, you know, I find it interesting, but I don't really get into that because there's no need to, because just by knowing that Hani Hanjour could not have flown a 757 into the Pentagon in that trajectory, right there we know the official story is false. And that's all I really focus on. I don't try to figure out what really happened that day, but just say, we know the official story is false, so what we need is a real investigation. And with that, you know, once you put people under subpoena, you threaten them with prison or death, and then you point out you will not get a pardon, you will not get this commuted, you need to tell the truth or else, people will start telling the truth. And once they do that, we can find out the answer to all those questions.
Another area you spent a lot of time researching has to do with the failure of the United States Air Force to intercept the planes before they hit their targets. You said in the new Pearl Harbor quote, "In light of the standard procedures for dealing with hijacked airplanes, not one of these planes should have reached its target, let alone all three of them," end quote. Could you talk about that aspect of the case?
Well, yes, and then because of that, the official story has changed.
Oh, if so, I could just ask you first, Professor, if you could explain what is the appropriate procedure when an emergency exists on an airplane?
Yeah, you have the standard danger signals. The first one is if the plane loses radio contact, it's called going NORDO, and you can't get the controller can't get it back quickly. Then the next danger signal is if the transponder goes off, and then the worst thing is if the plane goes off course and you can't get it quickly back on course, which, of course, you can't do if you lost radio contact. Well, that happened. That happened with Flight 11. That happened with the other flights.
And under the regs, when an emergency situation like that happens, what is the controller supposed to do?
Well, as soon as he's established that there is a real problem, and this is what they call an in-flight emergency, and this demands a faster response even than a hijacking. Certainly it did in those days, because if a plane has gone off course, it can cause all sorts of chaos in the air. So he immediately pushes a button. They have a hot button that gets them connected to the military within a second or two.
Would this be NORAD?
In this case, it would be NEADS, which is the northeast sector of NORAD.
I see.
So the country is divided into these different sectors, and that day they all occurred in the northeast sector.
Well, and then what is this part of NORAD supposed to do when it gets the emergency notification?
Well, then they call the nearest base that has fighters on alert and tells them to scramble, and that takes about 5 seconds, and then they blow the siren, and you've got these pilots that are on 24-hour alert. They're very close to the planes, and they run, hop in the planes. And normally, you know, there were statements before 9/11 saying we can go from scramble order to 29,000 feet in 2.5 minutes. They do tests. They do training exercises to knock seconds off these. Different companies compete with each other in these. And, you know, if you don't make it up for until 5 minutes, that's very embarrassing.
So once you've got the interceptor, they've located the plane that went off course or lost radio contact, what are they supposed to do?
Well, then they catch up to the plane, which they can do very quickly because the F-15s can go 1,800 miles an hour. The F-16s can go 1,500 miles an hour. And then they would normally get in front of the plane and wag their wings side by side, which means follow me. If the plane refuses, then they may fire a signal, a warning shot across the bow. And if that doesn't happen, then they're authorized to shoot down.
I see.
And
does that order have to come from the president, or can that come from a lower level?
It can come from a lower level. So that's one of the mystifying things has been told, that you know, this can only come from the president, and he was in the school in Sarasota, so they couldn't do it. Well, that's all nonsense, because in the very documents that people cite to show that, or that that had to go to Don Rumsfeld personally, and they said they couldn't find Rumsfeld that morning either, which was also a lie, The document says, except in cases of emergencies, and then it says in emergencies, anyone in the chain of command can issue the order. And I've been told by a fellow who used to work at the FAA Boston Center as a controller that that pilots are actually authorized to use their own discretion. If there's a plane that is getting ready to go into an urban area and look like it's going to crash into a building, they're authorized to shoot it down. But in any case, that day, none of that happened because they didn't do any
interception. It's academic. They weren't intercepted. But how many minutes should it take for this whole procedure from the time, say, a plane goes off course or loses a radio contact until the time it's intercepted? How many minutes is supposed to take place?
Normally about 10 minutes. We have statements before 9/11 that say that to warn pilots that if you go off course and don't obey, that you're going to find a couple jets on your tail within 10 minutes. So we can say certainly within 15 minutes they should have been intercepted.
And how often is this procedure done? Is it rare, or is it something that's done fairly often, the scrambling?
Scrambling is very common. Happens roughly 100 times a year, and that was standard for the decade prior to 9/11. Popular mechanics has really just lied through their teeth trying to say that. They said, the only interception ever made in the continental United States in the last 10 years was the Payne-Stewart incident. Well, I show in there that that's just a complete lie.
So if we look at the three aircraft that hit their targets, Flight 11, which struck the North Tower of the World Trade Center, Flight 175, which struck the South Tower, and Flight 77 or whatever struck the Pentagon. Should all of them have been intercepted under the procedures that and the time periods that we discussed?
That's right. And, you know, the one that with Flight 175, the second one, you had 20-minute notification, NORAD said. The whatever hit the Pentagon, they knew that Flight 77 was in trouble much before that. It actually had turned around about 40 minutes before that and came back through Washington. But there was, according to NORAD, notification at 9:24, and then according to the FAA, that's even late. They said, you know, we'd been talking about Flight 77 to the military long before the official notification time of 9:24.
So, I mean, in that case, I'm looking at your notes from your book that 8:46, that Flight 77 went significantly off course, and it didn't hit the Pentagon until 9:38, which is, you know, what, 40 minutes or more later.
Yeah, and then we've even got, you know, military people who said, before they knew what the official story was supposed to be, that they were notified about Flight 93 at 9:16. So they would have had at least 25 minutes.
Had that crashed about 10:06 in Pennsylvania?
Oh, yeah, and then Flight 93, yeah crashed at either 10:03, the official story, or 10:06, the story that everybody else tells.
Now, what was the as I understand from your book, the government's response and this failure to intercept has been changing. What is their latest story as to why they failed to intercept the planes?
They're claiming now that the military essentially lied to them when they said, we were notified about Flight 175, 77, and 193 in advance. The 9/11 Commission is saying, no, you weren't. You weren't notified. You didn't know that those planes had been hijacked until after they crashed. So, of course, you couldn't have intercepted them. And, you know, it just makes nonsense of all these stories, because we've got all these stories about the military saying, well, sure, we were tracking Flight 93. Wolfowitz said we were in position to shoot it down. Clark says we'd gotten the shoot down order about 9:50. In other words, at least 13 minutes before the flight crashed, and so on.
So the NORAD tapes, which they produced to the 9/11 Commission 3 years ago, they weren't consistent with what they'd been saying before?
That's right. They were absolutely inconsistent, evidently, on these crucial points. And, of course, the FBI had these tapes. The FBI and the military had these tapes all along, so nobody heard these tapes until 2004, at least 2.5 years after the event. So there was plenty of time for the tapes to be doctored.
Yes. Do you suspect they may have been?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you think that there may have been a stand-down order in effect on 9/11?
That is absolutely. In fact, we have Norman Mineta inadvertently told about an incident that sounds like Cheney having confirmed a stand-down order with regard to the Pentagon. Mineta says that he went down to the underground bunker under the White House, got there at 9:20. Cheney was already there, and about 5 minutes after Mineta got there, so about 9:25, this young man would come in the room and say that flight is now 50 miles out. Now it's 30 miles out. Now it's 10 miles out. Do the orders still stand? Cheney whipped his head around and said, of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything differently? Well, Mineta said he assumed that was a stand-down order, a shoot-down order. But, of course, whatever it was not shot down. And why would the young man questioned whether the order still stand if it was the expected order, that is, shoot down anything that comes close to the, you know, over this forbidden space, this forbidden triangle over Washington, D.C. So the 9/11 Commission has tried mightily to make that story disappear. They did not put Mineta's testimony in the 9/11 Commission report, even though it was given in open testimony to the Commission, and anybody can listen to it on YouTube. They took that out even of the archival edition of the 9/11 Commission of that session. The segment from Mineta is removed. They told other stories. They changed the time. They said Cheney didn't even get down to the bunker until almost 10 o'clock, perhaps 9:58. So they told about a 45-minute lie. So they were very concerned to block out, obliterate that story, because it did suggest Mineta had seen, had heard confirmation of stand-down orders.
Do you think some of the problems with the reports may have had to do with the fact that Philip Zelikow was the director of the 9/11 Commission?
I don't know why anyone would think that, just because he was essentially a member of the White House, had co-authored a book with Condoleezza Rice while the Republicans were out of office. He and she had been on the National Security Council with the first President Bush. And then she brought him in to author the National Security Strategy of the United States in 2002, which was this extremely bellicose doctrine document, which changed our doctrine of war, which said that we could now go to war against any country, even though that country wasn't threatening us. If we thought sometime in the future it might threaten us, we could go to war against it. So he used 9/11 as a pretext for changing that doctrine. And then in 2003, he's brought in to be the one to oversee the 9/11 Commission, which, among other things, should have been asking, was the White House somehow responsible, whether through incompetence or complicity, for the attacks of 9/11 succeeding? So it was just absolutely outrageous that Philip Zelikow was in charge. And, you know, people call it the Kane Commission and think that Kane and Hamilton, the co-chairs, were in charge. No, Zelikow, as the executive director, was in charge. He organized the committees that decided what things to investigate and what things not, and then he oversaw the writing of the 9/11 Commission report. And as I show in my chapter on Kane and Hamilton's new book, Hamilton had no idea what the 9/11 Commission report said on some crucial things. So he clearly was not in charge of overseeing the final version of it. Zelikow was.
You know, the 9/11 Commission and everyone in the media seems to take for granted the attack was planned and executed by Osama bin Laden, the head of al-Qaeda, and carried out by 19 suicidal hijackers. But did the Bush administration ever come out with a report which said, this is why we've come to this conclusion, A, B, C, and D?
They promised they would. Colin Powell, when he was still Secretary of State, said he was going to produce a white paper giving the proof that Osama did it. He never did. So Tony Blair produced such a paper, but Blair admitted it wouldn't stand up in a court of law. So in other words, it was good enough to go to war, but not good enough to go to court. Bush then demanded that the Taliban hand over Osama, and the Taliban said, we'll be happy to, just give us some evidence that he was involved in 9/11, and the Bush administration refused. And more recently, if you go on the FBI's most wanted terrorist website and look under Osama, spell it with a U, Osama bin Laden, you'll find that he's wanted for terrorist attacks on various American embassies, but he's not wanted for 9/11.
Why is that?
Well, Ed Haas, who has a report, you can find it on Google, called the Muckraker Report, called up the FBI and got a hold of Rex Toom, the head of investigative publicity, and said, well, why don't you list Osama as wanted for 9/11? And Toom said, because we have no hard evidence that Osama bin Laden was involved in 9/11.
I see. And some of the physical evidence connecting the hijackers seems to be easily questioned. For example, the luggage that Mohammed Atta supposedly left at the airport or wasn't transferred to his plane in Boston that he was hijacking, supposedly contained his passport, Will.
Yeah, this is what they used as their knockdown proof that Mohammed Atta was on Flight 11. They claim that he drove up from Boston to Portland the night before for some reason and then took a last-minute flight from Portland back down to Boston, which he could have easily missed. You know, the flight could have been delayed and the whole operation would have been screwed, so it would have been a really stupid thing. But anyway, this gave them an excuse to say that his plane, his luggage didn't make the plane, even though his plane was actually there an hour ahead of time. And so then they say they got the luggage and opened it up, and here was all this incriminating evidence, you know, Qurans and last-minute instructions and so on. And then, Muhammad Atta's will. And, you know, if you were planning to fly a plane into a building and turn it into a fiery inferno, you would certainly take your will with you.
It doesn't seem too likely.
And then they found the passport of one of the other alleged hijackers from Flight 11 under the World Trade Center. So somehow it popped out of the plane, or you know, maybe when the plane burst into fire in this huge fireball, this passport, maybe it had been fireproofed because it wasn't even singed. And was found, and there were different stories. Was it found after the towers collapsed or before? Then at Flight 93, at the crash site, what was supposed to be the crash site of it, although there was no sign of a plane, they said there was no sign because it went completely underground because it was coming down at this very steep angle at 580 degrees. And 580 miles an hour, and hit this soft soil in Pennsylvania, and the plane went completely into the ground, so much so that you couldn't even see the tail sticking out. But fortunately, on the ground outside, you had one of the passports of one of the hijackers, plus one of the red bandanas, and of course we had learned from some of the cell phone and airphone calls that the hijackers were wearing red bandanas. So that was proof. So it's hard to imagine, you know, you try to imagine this plane crashing into the ground at 580 miles an hour, and these things fall out. So evidently, you know, like most of us, if you're flying along at 580 miles an hour, you would have the windows open. So evidently that was it, and so the passport and the bandana
conveniently
just flew out the window just before the plane went into the ground. This is the level. I mean, this is such a Mickey Mouse operation. If the press would ever look at the details, it would be, you know, they would say, look, this is just so obvious. This is a standard false flag operation where there's some body that you want to go to war against, and so you stage an attack on yourself, and then you plant evidence that proves, you know, it was your enemy that did it. This is what Japan did when it was ready to go to war against China when it wanted to take over Manchuria, and this is what began the Pacific part of World War II. It's what Hitler did when he wanted to attack Poland. He dressed up a bunch of his troops as Poles, had him come across the border, and then he left a few dead bodies dressed in Polish uniforms and claimed that Poland had attacked Germany, so Germany was just doing a purely defensive operation against Poland. It's what we did when we wanted to start the Mexican-American War, when we started wanting to start the war in the Philippines. This is just the oldest story in the world.
It's not an original idea. Yes.
Yeah, and the fact that the evidence was planted at 9/11 is even more obvious than in these other cases.
With respect to false flag operations, there's one you mentioned, Operation Northwood, that comes somewhat close to this. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, this was shortly after Castro had taken back Cuba for the Cubans. And, you know, we had had it since 1898, when prior to another very dubious incident that we know as the Remember the Maine, where we claimed that Spain had blown up the U.S. battleship Maine, which would have been the last thing the Spanish would have done. But anyway, we had owned Cuba all that time, so we thought it was rightfully ours. And when Castro took it back for the Cubans, we were very upset because America was making a lot of money there, American business was. So the military was given the job of coming up when Kennedy got fed up with the CIA after Bay of Pigs fiasco. He turned the Cuba over to the military, and they came up with a bunch of scenarios which they themselves labeled as pretexts for attacking Cuba. And they had several pages of suggestions, and they would say, well, we could do this and we could do that, we could do that. One of them was we could blow up one of our ships, kind of a Remember the Maine incident. Another one was we could have American citizens attacked on the streets of Cuba, of Miami, and blame the Cubans. We could shoot down a plane and blame the Cubans. And
this came out of the Joint Chiefs of Staff?
Yeah, and all five of the Joint Chiefs of Staff signed off on this. So you had the military completely ready to go with these projects, even though they would have involved killing American citizens. So anybody who thinks our military wouldn't do such a thing, just go on Google and read Operation Northwoods.
Well, assuming it was, for the sake of argument, that we're dealing with a false flag operation, what were its objectives and who benefited from it?
Well, that's a long story. Short version of it is that the people who came into office with Bush and had leadership positions, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Pearl, and other members of this neoconservative organization called Project for the New American Century. They had been militating for an attack on Iraq really since 1992. They had been writing letters to Clinton saying, go ahead and attack Iraq. We need the oil. Ignore the UN. Ignore international law. We don't have to obey that. And Clinton wouldn't do it. I mean, what he did was bad enough with the sanctions that killed about 500,000 people, mainly women and children. But he wouldn't order a full-scale attack, as, of course, George Bush Sr. had refused to do. And that made these guys very angry, and so they were determined. So they came into office with attacking Iraq as the number one item. Richard Clark has said that. Paul O'Neill, who was in the cabinet, has said that.
There's a book of The Price of Loyalty about O'Neill, and he talks about how when he came into meetings, right after the Bush administration came in, that's all they talked about. They'd be poring over maps of oil fields.
Yeah, the only question was how. They said that nobody dealt with why or whether. It was just how to go about it, and then 9/11 provided that. Also, as I showed in New Pearl Harbor and in my second book, the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, we had plans on the books already to attack Afghanistan prior to 9/11. And so
that had something to do with the UNICAL's consortium.
That's
to
right.
Build a pipeline.
It had to, again, primarily with fuel. It was an oil and pipe gas line that one of our companies wanted to build that would go through Afghanistan. And the question was, how would that be protected?
And for those not familiar with geography, as I understand it, Afghanistan doesn't have the oil and gas, but the former Soviet republics on the north side of Afghanistan do. So you want to get those products through Afghanistan to reach Pakistan.
Yeah, and they wanted it to come down through Pakistan, which we considered a friendly nation, rather than going off in the other directions, which Russia would have preferred. And so there were competing interests, and there was what was called the big pipeline war over this. So it was a very big deal. And we had told the Taliban, you've got to form a unity government, which would mean essentially a government where people that we were would follow our orders were in charge, and they refused to do it. And our people said, evidently, well, we offered you a carpet of gold. Since you wouldn't take it, you'll be buried in a carpet of bombs.
Now, this was told to the Afghan representatives?
That's right, and told that the war would start before the snows of October, and certainly, and sure enough.
This would be a meeting in 2001.
This was a meeting in July in Berlin in 2001, and sure enough, by 9/11 happening coincidentally on 9/11, our military was ready to go by the second week of October before the snows had started. So
so one can trace both the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq to 9/11.
That's right. Of course, they had the stretch with Iraq because there were no Iraqis involved. But you remember the emotional times, all the fear of terrorism and the enormous prejudice against then Arabs and Muslims. So the very fact that Iraq was a Arab Muslim country, that was good enough, because many people said, well, we just, you know, we want to strike somebody, we don't really care too much who. And of course they lied, they're still lying, trying to connect Iraq to 9/11. So it was very easy, and I discussed that at a considerable length in my long book on the long chapter on the neocons in my third book about 9/11, which is called Christian Faith and the Truth Behind 9/11, which incidentally has a lot of things that my other books don't have. So it's an independently valuable book. And so I discuss in there at great length how they were able to massage the one into the other.
The connection between 9/11 and the new policies and the neocons seems to be evident in the paper Rebuilding America's Defenses, which the neocons published just before they took office.
That's right. In just a few months before the Bush-Cheney administration took office, this document was published by the Project for the New American Century. And being called Rebuilding America's Defenses, the idea was that even though we were spending about as much as the rest of the world put together on military matters, I mean, that's just incredible in itself, we needed to spend more. And they were talking about hundreds of billions of dollars more. And sure enough, after 9/11, that's what we've been doing. And they had five main things that had to be achieved in order to bring about what they called Pax Americana. The idea was that, you know, now that the Soviet Union has fallen, it's no longer a bipolar world, it's a unipolar world. We are the only superpower, so we can really run things. And that was the idea of a Pax Americana, first complete global empire in history. And they laid out these various conditions. One, of course, was this new doctrine of preemptive preventive war. One was the transformation of the military, which meant computerizing everything. And at the very capstone of that was putting weapons in space, including nuclear weapons. And this would be extremely expensive, costing at least $1 trillion just for the startup costs. And
they talk about Iraq in particular, don't they?
And they also talk about Iraq. That was one of the five pillars, yeah, of this new policy, of the conditions for Pax Americana, because, you know, Iraq being one of the major oil producers, and with one of the greatest reserves of oil in the world, perhaps the greatest. And so anyway, they said this was called the transformation of the military. And the document then said this transformation will probably occur slowly, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor.
Like a new Pearl Harbor.
And, of course, right after 9/11, I mean, on 9/11 itself, it was immediately called the Pearl Harbor of the 21st century. It was very clear people had been using that term already.
Point out, even to this day, we're talking 6 years later, 9/11 is still invoked by the administration as a justification for continuing the war in Iraq.
That's right. And that's why I say, and I see we're just about out of time, so let me make this my final point. I have spent almost all my time, literally, I would say 95% of my time, since the spring of 2003, when I finally woke up about 9/11, I spent all that time on 9/11 trying to expose the truth about it, because I'm convinced that until the truth is exposed, this insane policy that we're on now of increased militarism, while at the same time ignoring the true threat to our existence, which is global warming and the more general ecological crisis. I mean, we're going to be extremely lucky if we make it through this century. We'll be pretty lucky if we make it through halfway through this century without complete global collapse if we continue the trajectory on we're on now. And so unless we take seriously what Al Gore has been saying, and of course the scientists of the world have been saying, and devote the major share of our resources to this issue, we're not going to have much hope as a humanity. And so unless 9/11 is exposed and this whole fraud, which is called the War on Terror, and the whole idea that there's such a thing as a global terrorist movement, unless that is exposed and so we can bring it back to the level where it belongs, which is the level of crime, not war, and devote our resources and our energy and our intellect and our scientific knowledge and technological ability to the ecological crisis, we're not going to survive. So I hope your listeners will join in this effort to expose the truth about 9/11.
Thanks very much for being with us, Professor Griffin. This is Ken McDermott Rowe, and I've been talking to Professor David Ray Griffin about the attacks of 9/11. His most recent book on 9/11 is Debunking 9/11 Debunking. I'll be back in a moment with some final thoughts. This is Ken McDermott Rowe. Some interesting points cited in Professor Griffin's books on 9/11. 1. 11 days after the attack, BBC News reported that alleged hijacker Walid al-Shiri was alive and working as a pilot in Morocco. 2. A report appearing in the Wall Street Journal a month after the attack stated that General Ahmad, head of Pakistani intelligence, ordered that $100,000 be sent to alleged 9/11 ringleader, Mohammed Atta. And a report in the French press stated that General Ahmad met with CIA Director Tenet and other U.S. officials the week before the attack. 3. Within days of the attack, several publications, including Newsweek, carried reports that many of the alleged hijackers received training at secure U.S. military installations. 4. In a scientific paper, physics professor Stephen Jones concluded that the government's claim that the World Trade Center collapsed due to aircraft impact and fire was scientifically impossible. He observed that the vertical, symmetrical free fall of the buildings was consistent with a controlled demolition. please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of this program and others. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.